A live recording made as a video in Atlanta in 1988, one of the last major recitals given by George Bolet, B-O-L-E-T, the great Cuban-American pianist. He died in 1990, just 2 years after that, at the age of 76, of AIDS. It's 30 years on since the identification of what became known as, and now remains known as, AIDS. It began with the identification of strange infections, strange for very young people in their 20s and early 30s to have five young gay men in Los Angeles 30 years ago, reported on June 5th, 1981, a publication of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, also in Atlanta. Lots of circling around here in terms of history, connection, and identity. I'm Andrew Pattner. This is Critical Thinking on 98.7 WFMT and WFMT.com. Speaking with you this evening, June 6th, 2011, 30 years and a day from this anniversary. What's the line people will say in comedy worlds where trying to decide if it's time to tell the joke? Too soon, too soon. With AIDS, it's always too soon, too late, to everything. It's been something we as a society, we as artists, we as musicians, we as lovers of music, we as humans have been living with and living with on our minds without stopping, really, for many folks for 30 years. We'll be talking throughout the year about some different aspects of what AIDS has meant, what it means still. It's gone, of course, in this country from a death sentence, sometimes a very quick one, to, for many, many people, a treatable but chronic and serious and expensive illness. It's affected the rest of the world, of course, in even more broad and deep and numerically high ways. Today, though, I wanted just to take a chance to remember some individual people in the music world, listen to some music, and maybe read a few poems and just find a way that somehow gets between those rocks of too soon, too late, too everything. George Bolet playing the Godofsky transcription of the Albanese tango was a favorite piece of his. He had studied with Godofsky, and he had studied with Godofsky's students more deeply before that, but he also did study with Godofsky. That piece was also a favorite of a wonderful Chicago character, a wonderful Chicago pianist, a wonderful artist, a wonderful friend to so many of us, Sheldon Skolnick. He was a regular here as well on WFMT in the earlier days of live performance here and of in-house artists. Sheldon played with many orchestras around the U.S. He was a Chicago native. He studied with Mio. He attended Juilliard. He made his debut with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in 1957 at just 19, and his New York debut, when he was in his late 20s, 1966, at Philharmonic Hall, now Avery Fisher. He was a mainstay of Grant Park downtown and the CSO, St. Louis, San Francisco, Detroit. And he died in 1990 in the spring at just 52. Part of the thing when you look back at these things, 30 years, 20 years, 10 years, the folks who died, they're frozen in these younger beings. To think that Sheldon would be 73, that he was only 52, each of these pretty heavy stuff. One of Sheldon's lifelong friends, or at least from early adolescence on friends, is the composer John Corigliano. And when Sheldon, when George Bellette, when many other of John's friends were diagnosed with AIDS or became ill before AIDS was understood, the great pianist of the New York Philharmonic, the great harpsichordist Paul Jacobs, died in 1983, one of the very first significant name people, and certainly the first in the classical world to die of AIDS. Died in 1983. I'm just trying to recall. Let's see. He was only 52 at the time. But to think, how could Paul Jacobs, always so young, were he with us now, be 80, 81 years old? He was one of the first to go. And John had in his mind a need, not just an idea, but a need to write a piece. He was also the first composer in residence of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the first composer in residence as a really big deal of any major orchestra in the U.S. And for the centennial of the CSO, which would be in 1990, he had this commission for a symphony, and he decided to write a work that would memorialize his friends, challenge people about what was going on and about his feelings about it, and also allow for them to literally participate, because there would be not only the pieces that had inspired his friends musically and that were favorites of theirs to perform, but he would also have Sheldon actually playing the offstage piano for the Albanese Godofsky tango. Sheldon made it to the concerts March 15, 16, and 17 of 1990. That was the last time he was seen in public. He could be there, he could be there for the party, but he could not play at that point. And the wonderful Stephen Huff, who writes a lot about these things in addition to his amazing performances as a recitalist and as a soloist with CSO and many other orchestras, Stephen Huff did the offstage piano. It was to be recorded and performed by Schulte. He was coming to the end of his time at Chicago for various reasons. He wound up not doing the piece, and Daniel Barenboim, who was just coming in, said, "I'll do it, even though it's not my kind of world of music, but I'll do it." He did it, and it was the first LP recording, well, now CD recording, of Barenboim and the CSO, the Symphony No. 1 of John Corigliano, known by many as the AIDS Symphony. We're going to hear now the first movement. It's about 14 minutes. John calls it an apologue and tells us that an apologue is an allegorical narrative usually intended to convey a moral. Apologue of rage and remembrance. I read you just the first paragraph of John's notes from this original recording released in 1991. It won a Grammy for Best New Classical Composition, recorded live at those concerts of March 1990. Historically, Corigliano writes, many symphonists, Berlioz, Mahler, and Shostakovich, to name a few, have been inspired by important events affecting their lives, and perhaps occasionally their choice of the symphonic form was dictated by extra musical events. During the past decade, I have lost many friends and colleagues to the AIDS epidemic, and the cumulative effect of those losses has, naturally, deeply affected me. My first symphony was generated by feelings of loss, anger, and frustration. A few years ago, I was extremely moved when I first saw The Quilt, also known as the Names Project and the Names Quilt, an ambitious interweaving of several thousand fabric panels, each memorializing a person who had died of AIDS, and most importantly, each designed and constructed by his or her loved ones. This made me want to memorialize in music those I have lost and reflect on those I am losing. I decided to relate the first three movements of the symphony to three lifelong musician friends. In the third movement, which we won't hear today, still other friends are recalled in a quilt-like interweaving of motivic melodies. So the offstage piano here, Stephen Huff, playing a Baldwin in this case, the first movement, Apologue of Rage and Remembrance of the Symphony No. 1 by John Corigliano. Daniel Barenboim leads the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It's about 14 minutes, and after the loud parts, the rage, listen carefully. You're going to hear very quietly the remembrance, the offstage Albanith Godovsky tango.
Thank you.
written for, and later after his death in the spring of 1990 at 52 from AIDS, written for and dedicated to Sheldon Skolnick, dear friend of so many here in Chicago. The first movement of the Symphony No. 1, John Corigliano. We'll hear the fourth movement in a little bit. It's a work in four movements. Some years later, when Leonard Slatkin recorded the work with the National Symphony Orchestra, another winner of a Grammy for Best Classical Album, 96-97, there also was a chaconne made, a kind of solo cantata for mezzo, with a text by John Corigliano's longtime friend and collaborator William M. Hoffman. Together they wrote The Ghosts of Versailles, the opera, and the names were sort of put back in for the singer. I just mention a few: Giulio, G-I-U, Giulio Sorrentino, cellist, Freddie, Fortunato Arrico, Giulio's teacher, Paul Jacobs, the great pianist, J.J. Mitchell, muse of poets and painters, Jacques Schwatt, Mark Pearson and Jim Moses, Robert Jacobson, Nikos Kafkalith, Anthony, Tony, Holland, dear friend to so many of the original Second City era, and others were then memorialized by name in that chaconne. We'll hear that another day, another time. A few other names, just looking at the Estate Project, which for artists of all kinds works to keep the work of artists of every genre alive, preserved, and acknowledged, accredited, of all of those artists who died of AIDS. Looking here, just some names: Buddy Barnes, Mabel Mercer's wonderful accompanist George Bellett, the conductor Stuart Challender, the conductor Joseph D. Rugeris, who worked for a while in Chicago with Chicago Opera Theater, the pianist Yuri Egorov, harpsichordist and organist John Charles Ellis, Chicago friend and friend of Sheldon, Christian Giannini, died so young in 1991. Bruce Granger of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, who's heard as assistant principal bassoon on that recording of the Corigliano Symphony, died in 1996, just 42 years old. We mentioned Paul Jacobs. Christopher Keene, longtime conductor of the New York City Opera. Vladju Valentin Liberace, who was a real artist on top of all of his other things, and a great Midwesterner, of course. William Flugrat, conductor and composer. Scott Ross, remember when WFMT was playing over years all of the Scarlatti harpsichord sonatas, hundreds of them? That was Scott Ross, and he recorded, I think, a good 100 or so while he was dying. Sheldon Skolnick, we mentioned. Joseph Villa, pianist and piano teacher. The wonderful music writer K. Robert Schwartz. Patrick Giles, who wrote for Opera News until recently. Michael Bennett, and a few composers we'll mention. Warren Casey, whose Greece is running as the original Greece, as reimagined by his collaborator Jim Jacobs, still living. Klaus Nomi, Kevin Oldham, great composer for organ. Jonathan Spinnerman died so young, so young. So, how about some more music? No, how about a poem first, and then some more music? I have a few poems here that I think connect to what we're talking about. First of these is by Melvin Dixon. Melvin Dixon, 1950 to 1992, turning 40 in the 90s. We promised to grow old together, our dream since years ago when we began to celebrate our common tenderness and touch. So here we are, dry, ashy skin, falling hair, losing breath at the top of the stairs, forgetting things. Vials of Septra and AZT line the bedroom dresser like a boy's toy army poised for attack. Your red, my blue, and the casualties are real. Now the dimming in your man's eyes and mine, our bones ache as the muscles dissolve, exposing the fragile gates of ribs, our last defense, and we calculate pensions and premiums. You are not yet 45, and I not yet 40, but neither of us for long. No senior discounts here, so we clip coupons like squirrels in late November, foraging each remaining month or week, day or hour. We hold together against the throb and jab of yet another bone from out of nowhere poking through. You grip the walker, and I hobble with a cane. Two witnesses for our bent generation. Turning 40 in the 90s by Melvin Dixon. And here from Paul Monet, who chronicled the epidemic in so many ways, the loss of his lover, his own dying, novels, memoirs, poems. 1945 to 1995, he was a wonderful guest on Studs Terkel's program, too, here. Here, everything extraneous has burned away. This is how burning feels in the fall of the final year, not like leaves in a blue October, but as if the skin were a paper lantern full of trapped moths beating their fired wings. And yet I can lie on this hill just above you, a foot beside where I will lie myself soon, soon, and for all the rack and blubber, feel still how we were warriors when the merest morning sun in the garden was a kingdom. After room 1010, war is not all death. It turns out war is what little thing you hold on to, refugeed and far from home. Oh, sweetie, will you please forgive me this, that every time I opened a box of anything, glad bags, one-a-days, king size was the worst, I'd think, will you still be here when the box is empty? Raj, Raj, who will play boy with me now that I bucket with tears through it all? When I'd cling beside you, sobbing, you'd shrug it off with the quietest, I'm still here. I have your watch in the top drawer, which I don't dare wear yet. Help me, please. The boxes, grocery, home, day after day, the junk that keeps men spotless, but it doesn't matter now how long they last or I. The day has taken you with it, and all there is now is burning dark. The only green is up by the grave, and this little thing of telling the hill, I'm here, oh, I'm here. Here by Paul Monet. Let's hear the fourth movement now, the epilogue to John Corigliano's Symphony No. 1. You're going to hear the tango return. You're also going to hear the cello with Giulio's song appear. John Sharp is the soloist for that. Corigliano, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Daniel Barenboim, Stephen Huff, offstage piano, John Sharp, solo, cello, the epilogue to the Symphony No. 1, 1990, sometimes known as the AIDS Symphony. I'm Andrew Patner. You're listening to Critical Thinking, 98.7 WFMT and WFMT.com. You can hear us anytime via podcast, streaming, all that technological stuff. WFMT.com/critical thinking, and everything there is free. 30 years and one day since the identification of AIDS, what came to be known as AIDS originally, can you believe it, those of you who weren't around, it was called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. The word was if you were a Haitian or a hemophiliac or IV drug user or a homosexual, you had to be shunned. Dot, 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 dot. We'll fill in a lot of those blanks another time. For now, we're just looking back at some wonderful people lost over these 30 years. How about a wonderful singer whose career as a professional was as a boy at ages 12 and 13, David Navarro Edmonds, star boy soloist of the Chicago Children's Choir, my dear lifelong friend and roommate who died 20 years ago, born on the first day of summer in Chicago in 1959 and died on the last day of summer, first day of autumn in Chicago in 1990, just 31. So a little mini concert, first from live at Orchestra Hall, the Chicago Children's Choir in 1972, and then from Behold That Star, the Chicago Children's Choir in 1973, David Edmonds.
My only darling,
that in time
Old LPs. Chicago Children's Choir, Christopher Moore, founder and director, the late Christopher Moore. You heard from 1972, Easter evening in April then. David Edmonds singing the work arrangement of the spiritual Give Me Jesus. And then from recording sessions at the First Unitarian Church in Hyde Park, David again, the soloist in the Holst setting of Lule My Liking, and the spiritual Mary Had a Baby. The poet Elizabeth Bishop has been getting a lot of attention, fortunately, over the last few months because some new collections of letters, of poems, etc., have been published, republished, added to. She died back in 1979, well before AIDS, but she has a poem, One Art, that I think fits so well with what we've been thinking about, talking about, and listening to today. One art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day, except the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. One Art, Elizabeth Bishop. Michael Callan is going to close us out. Michael Callan was born in Rising Sun, Indiana, in 1955. He was a longtime survivor of full-blown AIDS, starting in 1982. He died in 1993 at age 38. He was a guest of mine on another radio station on more than one occasion. He had his wonderful group, the Flirtations, the a cappella group, and then his solo career. He also was a major AIDS activist and author. And again, looking at these pictures of him back from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, he'd be 56 if he were still with us today. We're going to go out with sort of an anthem of his in just a moment, Love Don't Need a Reason, from his album Purple Heart, 1988, when he was 33. But before that, I want to thank Matt DeStefano for putting the program together with me and making it sound great. I want to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Susan and Richard Kiphart, other friends of this program. Thank our assistant, associate, Tessa Cheruskin, for her aid. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other shows. Drop us a line. Rentap, it's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. Visit us online, WFMT.com/critical thinking, where you can experience the free Critical Thinking podcast. We're remembering 30 years and a day since the identification of AIDS and all that it left in its wake. We'll be revisiting it as well during the course of the year and years to come, probably, unfortunately. But for now, I'm Andrew Patner. Here's Michael Callan. We'll see you next week.
If your heart always did what a normal heart should do, if you always play a part instead of being who you really are, then you might just miss the one who's standing there. So instead of passing by, show him that you care. Instead of asking why me and why you, why not we two? 'Cause love don't need a reason. Love don't always rhyme, and love is all we have for now. What we don't have all the madness that we're taught, never questioning the rules that we're living lies we bought so long ago. How are they to know it's not who's wrong or right? It's just another way. I don't wanna fight, but no, I'm gonna stay. What we don't have is time.